Hey there, this is Kevan Devani of the Total Connector Show. Welcome, my friends, followers of the Total Connector, Total Bitcoin Show. I had a wonderful, highly fascinating educational talk with Matthew Mesinskis of Crypto Voices, who released together with his partner Fernando of the Crypto Voices the Q3 of 2019 Global Monetary Base. And, you know, I mean, who knows? Bitcoin could become eventually, sooner or later, in the next years and decades to come, the, you know, the final frontier, the final settlement layer, the final, you know, global monetary base. But until then, we've got to dig a little bit deeper and understand, you know, what is monetary base, as you can also, I urge you, by the way, to read the Twitter thread on Twitter's Crypto Voices and listen also to the podcast with Matthew Mesinskis and Fernando, and, you know, go step by step so you understand. So we talk about, you know, a spectrum of topics: monetary base, money, credit. You know, what is it when you have a claim on something, an institution such as a bank, you know, such as a deposit? We talk about gold and silver, which is, you know, base money of the past, but now, you know, government fiat is actually base money today and comprises both physical cash and digital cash component. We talk about, you know, a lot of other topics, debtor and creditor relationship. Austrian economics, of course, Rothbard, De Soto, Bob Murphy, Safeda Namouz. We talked about reserve ratio, full fractional reserve banking, full reserve banking, and, you know, even the mistakes or the misconception, misunderstanding even within the Austrian economics, which they've already paddled back a little bit on some definitions or explanations. We talked about, you know, what happens in the case of bank run, liquidity, free banking system, and, you know, and as Matthew Mesinskis said, I quote him, let the market decide. I fully agree with that. We talk about, you know, M1 base, we talk about malinvestments, we talk about a lot of other, you know, relevant, essential, interconnected topics, and of course, always in connection with Bitcoin, what kind of implication, what's the purpose, what's the meaning, what do we need to understand in order to, you know, have a bigger picture and have a, you know, bigger comprehension. All right. If you want to support me in any shape or form, please like, share, subscribe, follow me on whatever Twitter, my podcast show. First of all, my main podcast platform is anchor.fm/Kevan Devani, but you can listen to it on any other, you know, major podcast platform. Give it a positive review if you can on Apple's, iTunes, any other podcast platform. You can follow me on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and so forth. Now, I hope you're going to enjoy this talk as much as I did with Matthew Mesinskis of Crypto Voices, and let me know what you think. Thank you so much for your support, and thanks so much for listening. Welcome to the Total Connector Show. My name is Kevan Devani. I'm the host of the Total Bitcoin Show, and it's all about Bitcoin and Austrian economics. And today, my very special guest is Matthew Mesinskis, the host of Crypto Voices. Matthew, thanks so much for coming again to my show. How are you doing?
Good, very good. Thanks a lot for having me.
All right.
I'm with you more in the shade than I
Yeah, exactly. Started. Yeah.
Very mysterious.
Yeah, the winters is coming pretty extreme, probably more in Austria than in Riga.
Yeah, I was actually just in the U.S. and it was -9 Celsius as I flew out of
seriously?
Chicago. Yeah, and then got back to Riga and it was raining and like +11. So it
was Jesus, yeah. I mean, if it were up to me, I would just be not here in Austria seasonally for like half a year or whatever, yeah. You know. So, yeah. So the last time I saw you, you didn't go to the Berlin Lightning Conference.
I didn't make it. No, I heard.
Yeah, I didn't make it. Yeah. I saw you in Riga, right? That was the last time we saw.
Yeah.
It was a great conference.
Yeah, those guys do a great job. Really professional, and you know, they've really tried to be focused over the years, and it was great. It's great to meet them, obviously, being in the same geographic area. So they really do a good job every year.
Mm-hmm. You know, you, Matthew, and Eric Vasco, you are the, I think, the only ones who really make articulate distinction when it comes to money and credit. It's like, you know, the very strict teacher is like, no, this is money. If you don't, like, this is what I got all, you know, out of your podcast, like you're going through like step by step through your Twitter thread. Let me just show this for the YouTube viewers. Over here, because I listened to that podcast you did, and you went like step by step. And the thing I got out of it, because I want to, you know, also break it down for my listeners and our viewers, is when you have a claim on something, it's not money. It could, is that like the substrate of this?
Actually, I wouldn't completely say that. It is confusing to make these breaks and distinctions when you talked about trying to systematize money and stuff. Claims can be money. I would say claims can be money. It's just claims aren't base money. And that's the distinction we like to make for a variety of reasons, because basic money or base money is a money supply that has been sort of systematized and observed and categorized by economists for many, many years. And then these sort of claims, as you mentioned, which are accounts like checking accounts, savings accounts, time deposit accounts at banks or financial institutions. Those have been systematized more recently, although certainly like hundreds of years ago we had this data. But certainly like in the last century, the Federal Reserve actually did this a lot. Paul Volcker and them in like the 50s and 60s, they really started to develop this sort of a framework of this claim money, or what they call narrow and broad money, or what they also call M1, M2, M3. We can discuss all those if you want. But the distinction that we like to make is just that all of those money supplies, M1, M2, M3 accounts, you know, when you log into your financial institution, your bank, you see your name and your dashboard, and you see, you know, numbers on the screen, euros, dollars, whatever. At the end of the day, those are claims. Those accounts are claims. There are guarantees from the government, you know, up to certain dollar amounts or euro amounts. There's, you know, what they call FDIC insurance in the U.S. or some depository insurance in Europe. So that they kind of, we have, feel like there's some more security there, at least from the government. But at the end of the day, it's still a claim on that financial institution. So when you deposit basic money, and maybe now is the time to make the distinction between basic money. So if those accounts are claims, base money or basic money, that is something that's not a claim. It's something that's not a claim. So it's an important distinction. And, you know, in years of yore, you know, and gold, silver was base money well before gold. Then gold sort of officially became base money worldwide during the British Empire, although it had circulated as base money in the Roman Empire and the Byzantine Empire. Gold was certainly basic money because that was something that was not a plain claim. If you held the gold coin, it was yours. It was nobody else's liability. It was your asset, nobody else's liability. It was your asset, also your equity, but it was your asset. So that was something that you could use to pay debts if you needed, or to pay for things, so on and so forth. But the really important distinction that's not made a lot, and not really made a lot in Austrian economics, is that it's basic money basic money is sort of ultimate settlement. It's final settlement. There is no further claim when it comes to base money. So gold and silver sort of obviously served as that in the past. And then once central banking really sort of developed and took off for the last couple hundred years, you know, with the Bank of Sweden, the Bank of England, and then the Federal Reserve in the U.S. Those their notes, that their monopolized notes of issue, which they could issue, at the very beginning actually were claims as well. They started out kind of as private banks, the Fed, not as much, but Bank of England, Bank of Sweden, yes. They were issuing notes. They were sort of even bailing out and doing some of these things, but not in the same way that we hear today, like lender of last resort. But just as the years go by, we start to develop some comfort. The state gets involved. What has happened with those issues, their monopoly issue, is different than market issues of money, such as gold and silver, market mining of money. Those institutions, those central banks, eventually became to have known as their own basic money as well. So dollars, euros, yen, literally the physical things that you see in your wallet, holding your wallet, and then also the money that they literally as a ledger entry or as a digital printing press, what they put in their banking institutions' accounts. That's called the reserve account. Those two things together comprise the monetary base. And those things, so I started to talk about this process. It was gold and silver. And then eventually over the years, after World War I, gold standard really ended. And then really after World War II, there was like no chance of any competing bank holding it because Hitler basically made all of the gold leave Europe and enter the U.S. The U.S. was pretty centralized there holding the gold. And so central banks could claim on the U.S. their gold if they needed. France started to do that in the 60s, famously. And then since 1971, we've been, so really, literally only 50 years. You know, we've been hundreds of years, thousands of years with gold and silver as money, but literally only 50 years have we been in this sort of fiat world where fiat central money, the fiat monetary base, as well, represents something that's not a claim. And I don't say that in necessarily a good way, or I categorize that with gold. A lot of people think that, like, I categorize fiat, and, you know, Fernando and I both talk about this. When we talk about fiat as base money, like, we're sort of unfairly putting into this category with gold and silver. That's not the intent. It's just to show that they are monopoly issuers. They have full control. They can do whatever they want. And so it's at the end of the day, there is nothing behind the financial system other than their note of issue that could settle a debt. Not even gold and silver anymore. They have sort of strong-armed that out of the picture. So those monopoly issuers, those central banks, around the world today, they issue base money as well. So it's a long-winded way of saying, just to make it clear, two different types of money, but the really important distinction is that all of the money that you see in a bank, in a banking institution, in your depository institution, in your credit union, if you see it on the statement, your financial statement, that is a claim on that institution. It's not basic money. It's not something that doesn't have another liability. You know, you can't hold it in your hand. And so there comes the comparison with Bitcoin. That's what we've tried to make clear, is that's exactly what happens with Bitcoin's eventual 21 million units. When you remove Bitcoin from an exchange, you're holding basic money. There's no other claim, no other counterparty, no other check, Visa, PayPal, Venmo. There's only Bitcoin that sits mm-hmm. there. And that's mm-hmm. that's basic money. So it is, I'll stop talking here, but it is hard because we don't say that claims aren't money. Claims can be money, and circulate as money. We talk about, you know, our checking account as money, you know, how much money we have in our account or whatever, come payday. We talk about it all the time as money. It does circulate as money. It's just not base money. So that's mm-hmm. that's the distinction we make.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you before I forget that detail. I mean, it's self-explanatory, but when you have something in your deposit account, and you know you have this, what do you call it in US, it's called a federal deposit insurance.
Yeah, federal deposit.
Something different maybe in Austria. So it's, you know, up to whatever, 100,000 euro or something. So it's still a claim, because you would still, if they really screw up, or you would still have to sue or whatever, or go judicially after. Right.
Exactly. And we say that in every situation, you know, like if a bank goes under, which is rare because they're very safeguarded and whatnot. But if a bank goes under, what do you become as a depositor? You become a creditor. You're a creditor to the bank. You're always a creditor, but you're officially sort of known now in legalese as the creditor. You're waiting on the bank to sell off all of their assets, and then you're in line, as with all the other creditors, to get your money. And how that line forms is sometimes controversial. But that's just how it works. That's how the system has scaled. And like it was with Mt. Gox, Mt. Gox, Mt. Gox, as Andreas Antonopoulos says, I always love that. I like that as well. Mt. Gox, if you had Bitcoin there, and now the Bitcoin is not there, but there is some that's, in Japan, and they're working through in the legal system still. I think next year they're going to make another ruling on it. Maybe the final ruling, I can't remember, mm-hmm. but after, literally after 5 years of that, what are you, if you had Bitcoin and Mt. Gox, you're now a creditor. You're a creditor of Mt. Gox in the legal system. It's just how it works. It's how it works. There's no money there. At least there's not money the way you thought it was. You're going after assets. You're going to try to sell in the marketplace. Primarily that asset is Bitcoin. It's controlled by this administrator. And there's a lot of legal things to sort through.
Yeah.
But normal course of business, when business is working and people are just trying to satisfy supply and demand of money, what banks do, and also lending money, that relationship is simply one of debtor and creditor. And that's a hard thing, I think, that's a hard pill for a lot of Austrians to swallow that have read a lot of Rothbard primarily. Rothbard was the main man that really made the claim. He posited that fractional reserve banking was fraudulent. And I don't know if I want to go into that yet. We can.
No, it's important because there's a couple of, which I read a book, for example, of De Soto, Money, Credit, and I don't know what it's called, Economic, something like that.
The credit cycle or something.
Exactly. Doesn't it represent the same position like Rothbard?
It does.
It's actually criminal. I mean, it's actually, it's theft. It's whatever. It's embezzlement or, right? He goes even into the legal aspects of, what do you think about it?
Right. I mean, yeah. So Fernando, my co-host, his teacher was De Soto.
Oh, really?
Austrian economics from Madrid. Yep. Under De Soto. And I've met him. That's actually where Fernando and I met. It was at an Austrian event like 10 years ago now in Spain, not in Madrid, but in Salamanca. And sort of they were billing it at the time as the birthplace of economics, which was a really interesting event. A lot of European Austrians I met at the time there. Because that was like pre, not to get too many tangents, but that was like kind of pre-Twitter and pre a lot of sort of social media things for a lot of. So when we came together at that event, it was like, oh, there's a lot of other people reading these crazy economic textbooks as me. It's pretty interesting. So that was a great event. But in any event, I think De Soto is a wonderful economist and a wonderful sort of teacher. Of economic thought. I think as far as I can tell from Fernando, who obviously knows him better than me, is like he has great relationship with all of his students. Many of him disagree with him, by the way, on this point.
Really?
Juan Rayo would probably be the most famous one. He tends to represent this maturity mismatch school. Fernando kind of likes that as well. It's basically just saying, if you have a if you have 30-year paper, like if you have a 30-year sort of loan, then you need to just make sure you're matching that with 30-year sort of deposits. That's a very like extreme example, like say 5 years. So, you have a 5-year time deposit, then you can match that with a 5-year loan. And there's a lot of, I think, benefits to that. I'm not necessarily in any school that wants to like delineate specifically on how a bank should be run, because I'm a fan of the market, and I think I'm a big fan of caveat emptor, like let the buyer beware. We really should understand that, it comes down to the terms, and we're seeing this all the time in all random areas today, right? Like people aren't reading Twitter terms and then people are getting banned, but it's Twitter's decision to do that. And I don't like some of the times where that happens, but it happens. And there's a lot of social pressure that pushes back because people don't think those terms are just or right. So there's always push and pull with these things. There's no like hard and fast line. But one of the things, just to make it clear, that when you say a lot of these things, like we say that money is a claim in deposit institutions, people might think about a lot of the stuff that Rothbard wrote or that DeSoto wrote. This is just generally speaking, I can't like pick a general point here, but those points about banks being fraudulent, as far as I can tell, and I've heard a lot of Austrians today. So this is like Rothbard was starting, you know, these ideas in the 60s, 70s, you know, 80s, when he was really writing hardcore on banks being fraudulent. And then Dr. Selgin and Dr. White, who we've both had on our podcast, they're fans of this free banking school. Mm-hmm. On the other side, they started to argue more with him and Hans Hoppe in like the 90s. But anyway, just to show you, like, there's been a lot of argument about this over the years. The main point I wanted to say about the fraudulent aspect, though, is that most Austrians don't make that anymore. Very interesting. They used to, I think, follow Rothbard's lead a lot. DeSoto, I don't know enough about his recent writings. Like, I know in that book he makes the argument, but I don't know in his recent writings if he's really gung-ho about that anymore. But I've heard of many, I don't know about naming names or whatever, but like many prominent Austrians who argue about fractional versus free banking or fractional versus 100% reserve banking, they don't necessarily make the claim that it's fraudulent anymore. And we can talk mm-hmm. about why if mm-hmm. you want.
Yeah, that's why, now I get it. That's why Eric Vasco, remember, I don't know whether that was also mentioned in the panel discussion we once had with you and Eric Vasco, but you know, you've had talks also with Eric Vasco, I'm sure, where he's not a fan of DeSoto. I think the reason why is because of because DeSoto is sort of the proponent, advocate of full reserve banking. I mean, the point I think I got out of this is that without with a fully reserved banking, you cannot, you know, you cannot lend, you cannot produce, so there's no economic activity going. Is that the point? Maybe Eric Vasco was trying to make with DeSoto and the fractional versus the full.
I think he's trying to jump to the core idea that really what's happening. I say differently than Eric says. What I say, and what I think Fernando says as well, is that really what's happening is when you put your money into a bank, you're becoming, so let's bring it back all back to base money and to the claim and everything. When you put like $100 into the bank, you are taking basic money, which is on your balance sheet. So you have $100, let's just say $100. It was on your balance sheet, your personal balance sheet, is your asset, $100. You deposit it into the bank. Now, at that moment, in my view, in Fernando's view, and a lot of in Eric's view as well, and a lot of and this is how it goes legally, like this is upheld in courts and everything else. What happens at that moment is you don't have the $100 anymore. You don't have it. It's there you go. Nice. You're now.
I'm enlightened now. Right. Okay. Okay. The light is back on just for the listeners.
Yeah, if people are listening. So the $100 you have deposited into the bank, at that moment, you don't have $100 on your personal balance sheet anymore. You don't have the $100 bill. What you now have is an asset. You've swapped assets. So you don't have the $100 bill, but you have an asset called a claim against the bank. You have a deposit on the bank. And so what has happened in that transaction is the bank has gained $100, which they can do what they want. And they've also gained a liability of $100, which is your deposit. So you are the creditor to the bank. They are the debtor. That is fixed. There is no, like, there can't be any dispute about that. That is legally, economically, accounting wise, what happens is that's what happens. Now, a lot of the arguments, I don't even know if I can do them justice, but a lot of the old arguments, I think DeSoto uses some of this as well. What they say is that, you know, you expect to get that $100 back, this and that. So what's happening is there's a dual property certificate sort of thing going on right now. Is you think you have a property certificate of $100, but then the bank lends out that money and they think that they have, someone else thinks that they have it as well. It's not how it works, you know, legally, systemically, economically. And again, this is why most Austrians don't argue that it's fraudulent anymore. If you would read your banking terms, if they don't say explicitly, we're the debtor, you're the creditor, to your funds. Like you have a claim on the money that you deposited. They might use the term specifically debtor creditor. If they don't say that, they're going to use other legal terms like we have the right to use your funds the way we see fit. You can claim this and that. Like they're going to use all those terms legally. So it's there in black and white. It's just people don't really want to read the terms of a depository right. agreement of a checking account agreement. So that's one issue. Another issue that's used a lot is the idea of this reserve ratio. I don't know if I want to go in there yet because I like to try to keep things very simple when I. So the reserve, let's do it quickly. So the reserve mm-hmm. ratio is one thing that I'm not a fan of because it is a monopolistic, mm-hmm. monopolistic thing. Reserve ratio is what the what each central bank sets for their commercial banks. I've said this before. I have a lot of thoughts coming when I'm upgrading my website and a lot of these money supplies, and it will all come out in writing as well. But the reserve ratio is basically a thing that has developed over the last, 100 years, where central banks tell each commercial bank in their jurisdiction, in their nation, how much they need in base money, which is that reserves that they are granted by the central bank and the physical currency, which is a very small proportion, by the way. It's very small, like usually 90 to 95% of physical currency is just floating around in the economy. It's in grocery stores, it's in shoe stores, it's under beds. Most currency is not in banks, physical currency. There's only like 5 to 10% that's actually in bank vaults, and probably less than that even. So there's two things that banks have as reserves to this reserve ratio. The first is a little bit of physical cash and mostly this ledger entry or their deposit with the central bank. And the central bank can control that amount. How they do that, again, buying and selling bonds from those banks, whatever. We don't need to get into that. But those are the reserves that each bank holds. Now, the claim from Austrians is that those reserves need to be 100% to demand deposits, particular demand deposits they have a rub with. They don't necessarily, if it's a time deposit and there's an interest rate, it's clear that it's being lent, they sort of concede that point that doesn't need to be that doesn't need to be reserved 100%, but they really want that the demand deposit is 100%. So now we get back to the point that Eric said. It must be fraudulent if less than 100% of what I put in with that $100 bill is kept in reserve in the bank because I think it's there. I got to get it back, so on and so forth. This is where now I would. Like I'm trying to say that we can break from all sorts of dogma here and just say, why can't we just let the market decide what the reserve ratio wants to be? So that doesn't happen in today's system. It's one more bad thing in today's system is the reserve ratio. I've said this a lot. Like, tell me why the Federal Reserve would know what the reserve ratio of a bank in New York should be versus a bank in Wyoming. Or tell me why the European Central Bank should know what the reserve ratio should be for a bank in Latvia versus a bank in Austria. You know, like there's no correlation there. I mean, it's markets are a complete local thing to everyone, always. You know, it's emergent supply and demand. People want to borrow money. People want to spend money. There's no reason why the central bank should know that reserve ratio. So even before we get through the door of this fractional reserve banking argument, I would say we're in a, besides the fact that everybody knows we're in a distorted system because they can print the money at will, it's also a distorted system. And it's a very, very important point is that they can set the reserve ratio at will. So the reserve ratio typically has been 10% in the US, and that's actually for only large institutions. For smaller institutions, it's actually less. A lot of people don't know that. Mm-hmm. I just say, why does it have to be anything? Like, why can't we let each institution decide? And that's what I believe. That's what I believe is that the market would be able to decide the reserve ratio. But we're just not in that system. We're in a very concentrated, monopolized, centralized banking system where banks set the reserve ratio. So you can, hopefully it's the next point that I might make here is sort of, it's easy to see where I'm going, is that how can we now debate, if we're Austrians, right? How can we now debate that 100% reserve ratio is like the best way to go and the only way to go, versus maybe on the other extreme would be Dr. Selge and Dr. White, who have always argued this point, pointed free banking systems in the past that didn't have central banks. Their reserve ratio, and this is a fact, their reserve ratio, banks in Scotland and Canada, was less than 1%, sometimes less than 3%, sometimes less than 5%. But their reserve ratio was very, very small of gold specie, that is like the actual base money, compared to the demand deposits that were outstanding in the economy. I just think no one knows. I think no one knows that answer. I might have said this on your show. I've said it a couple times. I think it's interesting. This is one person that was on our show, Bob Murphy. He used to be a free banker. Now he's a full reserve banker. He said this on our show, like unprompted by me. He said, I don't think the reserve ratio would literally be in a free banking system, in a anarcho-capitalist system. I don't think it would be literally 100%, but I think it would be a lot higher than Dr. Selgin thinks. And they debated about this a couple of years ago in the Soho Forum, maybe a year and a half ago, which is a debate I really encourage your listeners to watch. It's Bob Murphy versus George Selgin.
It's funny you mentioned Bob Murphy, because coincidentally, he is right now in Vienna at some kind of Austrian economics conference.
Oh, interesting. It could be the same that we went to, actually. I haven't checked, but it could be the same type of thing that we did. Where I met Fernando many, many years ago. That was the Mises Institute. I think it was a donors recognition conference. But in any event, look, I don't even like to name names like that, because I really like Bob Murphy, and it's not I'm not trying to win a war on like economic ideas. I think at the end of the day, caveat emptor, let the market decide what the reserve ratio should be. And if it's an institution that merits those deposits, meaning it performs over the years, it makes. And so what now we need to talk about what happens with that money, right? Now we can get back to this $100 gets deposited, whatever. What is actually happening when you deposit $100 into the bank? Well, the Austrians would argue that it's not clear that it's being lent out. Okay. I've kind of addressed most of that, I think, but you know, it's in the loan agreement, caveat emptor, it's a bank. You know that they're engaging in lending activities. Like that should be understand that they're lending all money. Doesn't matter if there's an interest rate paid or not. But, and again, there are legal problems with that, because interest rates on demand deposits were stopped for some time in the US. Now they're sort of back, but they're low now, or they're not going negative yet in the US. But anyway, it should be clear that the banks lend money. But what is actually happening there? Okay, so again, your $100, you have now, you don't have the $100, you just don't have it. It's not there, it's not physically on you. It's not in the bank physically either. What you have now is a claim on the bank. But that doesn't mean that the bank has nothing. That doesn't mean that the bank on the other side of that ledger is like, there's nothing there. No, they have assets. The bank now has assets. So the bank takes that $100, it loans it productively. And officially, again, the ratio is usually 90-10, right? So 90% loaned out, 10% held in reserve. That I have a problem with that. I don't think it needs to be that ratio. No one knows what the ratio should be. It should be emergent. It should be the banks, the banking competitive market to determine that. There's no reason why it should be 10%. No reason at all. But the actual nature of what happened to the $100 bill, it's not like it just disappeared into the economy, or that many other people think that they have that $100 now because it was loaned out. No, it's loaned. Lent out to certain parties. There's a new loan agreement now signed with those parties. That party might have a $90 loan, right, that was just engaged with the bank. And then that party goes and spends that money immediately on something else. And the money starts working through the economy. And that's how you scale a system. That's why people start to say like things like credit is the lifeblood of the economy. I don't believe that statement either. But that's just what's happening in lending. That's the market of lending, is that money goes through the system, it's deposited, it's lent out, this and that. Now, I do want to say one point again about this sort of general scary idea that Austrians, you can look at any article on Mises.org. And again, I'm a fan of Mises.org, but if you look at any article about fractional reserve banking, you're going to see this idea. And the idea is you have $100 deposited in the bank. The bank takes 90 of that, loans it out. 90 of that is spent, deposited into another bank. The bank takes roughly 80 of that, loans it out. And so you go on this very, very extreme cycle of lending money that everybody thinks they have $100 in the bank, and you have like now $1,900 that's basically lent out. Because everybody is basically keeping that $100 in reserve, but they've created $900 in loans based roughly. I'm just doing very, very rough numbers there on the 10% reserve.
Maybe rate. You're going to get to that point, Matthew, but what if there was a bank run? Just briefly, what would happen if, you know, I mean, it could happen. I mean, you know, the IMF and whatever, the central banks are talking about negative interest rates, or, you know, abolishing, you know, getting rid of physical cash. And what if people, you know, all of a sudden woke up and say, you know, I mean, we are here in Europe and, you know, we're not isolated. We're not immune to this whole thing, the negative rates. So what would happen to you know, to bank in case of a bank run to those deposits?
Well, the question on the soundness of those deposits has to do with the liquidity of the assets. So as I mentioned, Fernando's a fan of this maturity mismatch school. Ron Ryo is as well. Many others, former DeSoto students as well. As long as you have liquidity on the asset side of your balance sheet that matches the term of the demand, meaning basically on demand, zero months, like you can just come in whenever, then you should be able to handle any run that happens. That's if you strictly view this sort of maturity matching school where, you know, you might have, I don't know, 1 month paper with the government or with the corporation even that pays you a bit of interest, gets you a bit of spread, lets the bank work productively with their own capital and with their depositors' capital to keep things moving. And then if there is an outsized movement in the run, in their deposits being redeemed, right? If there's a run, as they say, you'll be able to liquidate those securities that are short term to pay. That would be in a sound banking system. It may be that there's not sound practices with a lot of these banks. They might not be matching their maturities well. It may be. But again, like that's not anything I would even be interested in talking about. Like, 'cause then you go back to this idea about regulation, reserve ratios, deposit insurance. Like these are just things that the state has come up with because the state doesn't allow free banking. If it allowed free banking, then we would have hyper-competitive lending, depositing, people getting interest. You know, why would you even want to run if you had like, I don't know, Apple Pay working really well and Apple was paying you some interest and Apple got into the banking business, consumer credit a little bit. There's all sorts of things that could happen in a free banking system where people can issue claims that circulate as money, right? Those deposits, that's the whole thing. Deposits, claims, they circulate as money. People can issue that, but it doesn't have to be a central bank. So I don't know like the all-encompassing answer to your question, Kayvon, other than to say there are examples in history where the runs occur precisely because a bank is managing their assets badly. Runs don't occur on banks that manage their assets well. That has shown to be true in free banking systems. So, and again, we don't have it. It's a theoretical debate. We just don't have it. The reserve ratio of 10% is just, it's an insane thing in my mind to even like argue about. Like it's set. The central bank set it. There's no way they know it. There's no way that any Austrian knows that that 10% reserve ratio should be 100%. And there's no way that I know that it should be less than 10%. And I'm not arguing that it should be less than 10%. I'm just saying there has been evidence that banks have worked well with the base money being actually well less than 10% of the demand deposits that are outstanding. So the last thing I want to say about this go back to this point about fractional reserve banking and this typical example that basically you deposit $100 into the system or $1,000 into the system, and basically 9x of that is all this is like new bank credit that's all of a sudden out there, and it just sort of like, you know, every $100 we have now $900 more dollars of bank credit. systemically, that's completely wrong. It's completely, completely wrong. It's never happened that way. You can look at the numbers. It's an incorrect model of looking at a system. And again, I know that I'm now wading into talking about the government-sponsored reserve ratio, because again, I just said I don't like that, but well, we can easily describe how that's a wrong way. So a bank receives $100 in a new deposit, right? And so then they lend out 90. So now they have, there's $90 that's out there. Now, the what happens in the, as it goes through the steps, is that that base money is always the sort of the trigger of how much can be lent out. So if I go out and I take 100, if someone goes and takes a loan, right, of 90 in the next scale, the next step of lending, okay, anybody that takes that $90 out of the bank to, you know, pay for something else, they've immediately removed the lending power of that bank. And so it was with the bank that gave me the $100. So who paid me the $100? Presumably I took it from a bank. Whether I got it from my paycheck or whatever, I got it from a loan. If I took the $100 from a bank, this is the spot that's always ignored, is I have immediately removed $100 of lending power from the other bank, actually $900, because they can reserve it, 9 to 1, basically. So no one talks about this step before me. So I have $100 that I took from some bank, I put it in another bank, but systemically nothing actually happened. So I took $100 from one bank, that bank systemically lost $900 of lending power. They lost, I think I said $100 lending power before, $900 of lending power, $100 of base money. That bank lost it from their assets. Another bank gained it. So that's actually what's happened, is systemically, you're just, people remove money from banks, they put money in banks. The only institution under our current system that can increase this proportion of base money to total outstanding deposits is in fact the central bank, by two ways. Mm-hmm. The central bank can either increase the base money in the total supply, or they can change the reserve ratio. But this general idea, which you see all the time on Mises.org or whatnot, is that this pyramid of $100 to $900 in credit happens with every $100 bill that's floating around the economy. And it's just not true, because no one talks about the step before. And the step before I deposited my $100 in the bank is I took it from another bank. Either someone lent it to me, I was paid, and then I took it out. So that's a very, very key component, is that systemically, the chain of the steps there, it's just very important to look at not just one bank and one bank's lending power to the next bank, this and that, but to understand that every time $100 is taken out of one bank, then you are removing that fractional reserve lending power, whatever, from that bank. So systemically, we're even. Systemically, we're even. And this you will see. Like, you don't see, you would just assume by this sort of, these general articles about how $100 gets lent into $900 every time, you would assume that we just have like $1 quadrillion in demand deposits in the economy. It's just not the case. We have, it is true that overall, like say M3, like the most broadest money supply, so we're talking about these claims earlier, this is like time deposits, large corporation time deposits. Like, where does Warren Buffett put his money? It's usually in time deposits after he takes out of the stock market. There's like very, very, all of these big, big, massive claims. It is true that those have generally grown, you know, in the last 50 years as a proportion of base money, but demand deposits actually have stayed the same or gone down. Meaning, if you had, say, I'm just using, I have this somewhere, but I don't know if I can pull it up right now, but let's just say an example. Let's say the stock of base money increased 30 times in the last 50 years in the US. then the stock of M1, that is demand deposits, minus you need to remove the physical cash because physical cash is also in M1. But if you just look at demand deposit component of M1, that has increased actually less than 30 times. And I don't say that's good or bad. I'm just saying it's not the example of what you would assume. You would assume under the typical $100 into a bank, it's lent to $900, then the next $100 goes in, and we're just like in this sea of money. It's just not how it works, because systemically, every time one person removes $100, you know, which starts that chain, that bank lost $900 in lending power. So there's always this push-pull between the banks, and you just, the numbers don't lie there, that there is no like massive pyramiding of demand deposits and then other deposits on top of this base money in banks. There's just this general reserve ratio that goes from bank to bank, usually stays around 10%. And I'm speaking about the US specifically here. That's the money supply that I know the most as far as these demand deposits relationships go. It usually stays around 10%. So systemically, I know I'm sort of jumping around here, but I hope that point is clear. Systemically, it hasn't changed, meaning the monetary base, say it increased. I'll just give concrete listener numbers to your listeners here.
Would you say those numbers that you also, you know, elaborated and worked it out, is that like verifiable, or do you think other numbers that are obfuscated or
he
disclosed, you know, like really whatever offshore, I don't know. You know.
Sure. No, I mean, that's a good point. Like, there are many things in the banking system that are opaque. What I'm using numbers that the main regulator has disclosed, Federal Reserve. It's not a blockchain. There's no understanding that those claims are completely accurate. Absolutely. But, you know, economists, whether they want to argue their points one way or the other, will always use these numbers. But no one looks at the overall totals. So just to give your listeners, and I'll have more written up about this over time, but it's going to take some time. So here we go. The size of base money in banks, right, which is the small physical portion of cash in bank vaults, and reserves, which is completely decided by the Federal Reserve or the central bank. The size of base money in banks in the last 50 years has gone up about 100x. It was actually close to 200x right around 2014 when there was like massive quantitative easing. It's come down, but you know, in 1970 it was 1x. Here in 2019, August, I think is my last data here, it's 97x. So I mean,
it's crazy.
It is a crazy number. It's a crazy number. But again, if as long as demand for that money is met, prices won't rise. But as we notice, prices rise. So demand is never enough to counter for the increase in supply. So again, I don't want to like, maybe there's some good reason at some point to do it, but I would never defend the regulator in that way. I'm just saying it's been up 97x. Now here's the interesting thing. M1 deposits are only up 13x. They're only up 13x. So what that means is for every dollar in the monetary base in a bank, which is their lending power, that's their lending power, that they can lend 9 times to every one that they have in the bank, it's actually gone down, the ratio of 97 divided by 13. You're at basically for every dollar, and this is I'm going to tell you before the financial crisis and then after. So before the financial crisis, which was September 2008, August 2008, it was about 68 cents. So every dollar in base money that was added to banks by the Federal Reserve, M1 deposits only increased 67 cents, right? That's up until the financial crisis. But then if you divide that number that I just told you, 97 by 13, you get a much lower number because reserves just exploded. Everything since 2008, like all the numbers have just gone wacky with what they've done. Now, M1 has only increased 14 cents. But either way, post-crisis or now, M1, and that, when I say M1, I think demand deposits, the demand deposit component of M1, not the physical currency component, just M1 demand deposits. it's increased at a slower amount than the monetary base. That's completely counter to any sort of
rational.
No. Well, I mean, it's counter to what you hear about the dangers of fractional reserve banking, or that put $100 in the bank and it just inflates the heck out of the money supply, what people think they have in the money supply, so on and so forth. Those numbers are just much, much more tame than most people might expect. Now, I'm not saying that there is not credit that has been made in that time, which was malinvested or basically just misappropriated. There absolutely has been. That's a core component of Austrian theory, and I absolutely agree with that. I'm not a fan of the central bank money monopoly in society, but you need to parse through, I think, a couple of these things just by looking at the facts. And the facts are that the demand deposits, contrary to what you might have read, actually decrease at a slower rate than base money in banks, their lending power. And that has that was true before the financial crisis and now. And now it's even less so. You know, 97 divided by 13, whatever I showed you there. You know, so for every dollar of base money in banks, the demand deposits have only increased 14 cents right now since in the last 50 years. Of course, again, that's things have really gotten out of proportion. But if you look before the financial crisis, they only increased by 67 cents. Mm-hmm. So it just shows that banks aren't really like making these deposits in a crazy way that you would think. But again, I every time you say these stats, people think like, oh, well, then you must be in favor of the way that the central bank regulates. No, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm just saying this is one way to scale a system. This is how it's been done. It's not done the way that you necessarily think. You have to actually have to look at the data there. And you know, and that's it. Like I would much rather have a free banking system where you didn't have any of these reserve ratios, you didn't have any monopoly provider of the base money stock, then it would be a really competitive system. We don't have that, so that is why we focus on Bitcoin.
Right. So yeah, now that you mentioned Bitcoin, can we tie this in into Bitcoin? First of all, let me ask you first, you know, there's this official number of global debt, which is approximately $250 trillion US, sort of. And then if you add the unfunded liabilities and whatever derivatives, you get like a, you know, a crazy insane number of 1.8 quadrillion. What is it? What's the implication? What, I mean, what does it mean for Bitcoin, and what would change if it was, you know, got reduced and increased, you know, the monetary base? Like, is there a bigger comprehension, you know, for the average person to understand? What does it mean for, you know, for the average person out there in the future?
Yeah, so global debt has, that's the one metric that sort of does stay relatively consistent with the monetary base. Mm-hmm. So as I told you, demand deposits have actually gone down relative to the monetary base increase. Global debt is more or less the same. Actually, I say government debt. I'm going to chop out a lot of the other things, like you said, corporate debt, derivatives, everything else. But if you looked at the real money multiplier of government debt, it's usually 1-to-1. So it, again, last 50 years, you started both at 1-to-1, whatever they were, right? They were 1-to-1 each number. Before 2008, government debt was actually $2 to every dollar increase in the monetary base. So we were able to increase global debt a little bit faster. And that fell in the 2000, that post-crisis. And now that ratio is about 1.15. And it fell to like 0.8 a couple years ago. So what that means is basically it's pretty close to 1-to-1. So whatever the monetary base does, global debt can do. That makes sense, because monetary base, pretty much most of it funds government bonds. It funds the shortfall that the government can't sell into the market. The Federal Reserve has to buy that with printed money. So there's no indication that that might change. As long as they can hold on to the monopoly printing power and they can print money to cover shortfalls in their respective governments, I think they're going to do that. if the market, you know, a lot of people like to say there's a couple years ago, and even now, you know, they used to call them the bond vigilantes, you know, the people that thought that the bond prices were just way too high and they were going to short the heck out of them and make the government lose control. They haven't been able to do that yet, these bond vigilantes that the free market capitalists are hoping for. I would like them to. I mean, I don't have any vested interest in government debt. I would like it to sort of be more rational and whatnot. The tough thing about all these numbers is that, again, I'm describing them in a system that's monopolized. You know, it's a system of one central issuer. We just don't know what it would be like in a system where we had competitive money that could restrain governments, where they couldn't, you know, just tax and spend and print. They could only just tax and spend. And, you know, it's hard to know. I gave another chart in my recent release on the monetary base, which I think is a really interesting one. It's if you look at the global monetary base, which right now in dollar terms about 19 trillion, it's fallen because a lot of currencies has fallen against the dollar. It was like 21 trillion 2 years ago. It's not that they're printing less money. It's just that there's one sort of exchange rate you can look at, and that's the dollar. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the euro, the yen, the yuan, they've all fallen against the dollar a little bit in recent years. So the global number is fallen. So anyway, about 19 trillion. And if you look at all the gold in those banks, this is the top 30 floating currencies in the world. It's like 95% of global GDP. If you look at all the gold that sits in those banks, if you're a believer in gold as being like real money, like sound money, they still hold gold, but that's only about 7% of that number. Mm-hmm. So it's a trillion something, whatever. So it's 19 trillion. I think it's 7% is the exact, just a quick. Yeah, it's like 1.3 trillion in gold in dollar terms, right? So what does that indicate? That indicates that of about 17.5 or more of the monetary base in US dollar terms is seniorage. That's one definition of seniorage if you believe that gold is market money. And they've been able to print, you know, over, that's an outstanding number. It's not like every year or whatever, it's outstanding. So, you know, every year they've been able to keep, and generally that number increases, right? So they've been able to increase this seniorage globally that amounts something in the range of 17.5 trillion in base money. That clears the value of the gold that those monopoly issuers hold. So that is seniors. That literally is printing money above the cost that it does for you to either the cost for you to do it or the cost of market money in this way, gold. So it's a big number. Do I think that it will stop there, or will there be, you know, any big market change? I don't know. I mean, I think one important thing to know with these central banks is that they're not all in unison, particularly China. You know, it may be that the ECB, the BOJ, the Bank of Japan, and the Fed coordinate and like talk a lot. But you have this huge outlier that's China. I don't think China does a lot of good things with their social, you know, policies. But at least as a competitor on the monetary scale, they are there and they have entered the arena. And this is why you have all this stuff about digital currencies, centrally backed mm-hmm. digital currencies. CBDCs, all these sorts of things, central bank digital currencies. Like, everybody's trying to see where this new monetary order will sort of fall and shake out, and China's absolutely going to be a part of that. So, you know, years ago it was talking about adding the yuan to the SDR basket. Mm-hmm. Now it's talking about maybe we need a digital currency with the yuan in it. The Libra's getting in there to sort of mess it up. What's the Libra basket going to be? Yeah, these are definitely big things. And I try to not make too many predictions, primarily because a lot of hard money people have been disappointed in the past. You know, we've seen the power that the state can hold when it comes not only to money, but to everything, like enforcing their will, enforcing laws, you know, defense, all these things. Like, there's a lot of things that go into money. Measuring the money stock is very interesting. Measuring the, as I told you, some of these real money multipliers, like if something increases, if the monetary base increases, how much does something else increase? That's a very interesting thing. But at the end of the day, like, you know, I say this all the time. If you were a gold bug in 1980, you would have been disappointed for the next 20 years. Right. That's a bear market. And they actually,
that's a pretty long bear market we've had, huh? I mean, gold, this is like 20 years or what? I mean,
20 years, 1980 to 2000.
Yeah. By the way, is it true? I mean, I heard it. I know Max Kaiser, some kind of expert, the reports allegedly, I don't know. I mean, we don't go into speculation. China allegedly has much more gold, something like in the range of 20, 21,000 tons of gold. If that is, I mean, if that is true, then wow. I mean, this is,
I haven't heard. I mean, I have the official gold holdings. Let me let me check really
quick. Of course, they've been accumulating, not only China, but, you know, Russia, all central banks have been accumulating like crazy.
Yeah, they have. But again, that stat I just said is indicative there, because it still shows primarily the power of the Western central banks, because that stat in 1980 was 80%. Of course, that was gold is at its all-time high in U.S. dollar terms. The gold that sat in central banks in 1980 was 80% of the monetary base that was printed. So it was massive. Now it's only 7%. So it shows that they've all been able to print more. And by the way, China wants to do this too. It's not like they could say they're buying gold. Russia would love to do this. Russia would love to print. You know, they say that they're buying, they are buying gold. Absolutely. A lot of these emerging central banks are. But still, the blended overall proportion is as low as it's ever been. You know, 7% of the monetary base. So it just shows they can print money well above the value of their gold reserves. And I think they're just going to continue to do that. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious what you just said about Max Kaiser. Let me look at the numbers that I have. These are official gold reserves. I like to put them into ounces too. So I just because I like, you know, I think that that's a nice, you know, market.
Because one thing is sure, I mean, that is admitted that there is part of the gold hoardings or whatever accumulation that is not disclosed by a lot of central banks or governments.
I'm sure that that's true too. I'm sure that that's true. Again, like, none of this stuff is a blockchain. Never going to know for sure. The number that I have is, so he said 20.
That's 1,000
tons.
Yeah, something like that.
21,000 tons. You remember that number?
Yeah,
that's huge. Because I'm looking at only 1,000 here, roughly.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
But actually, close to 2,000. Close to 2,000. 2,000 tons. So you're talking 10x of the official number. Maybe. Again, that goes back to emerging competitive sort of threat level stuff that every central bank is going against everyone else. Like I think it's, the jury is just still out on so much of this, because, you know, Bitcoin I think will play a role, but it's just going to be a long time before, like, if Bitcoin really supersedes all of them, and I believe that it has a very good chance of doing that.
But don't you think it could happen much faster? Because, I mean, you know, as also Safed and Amos and many other, you know, people said Bitcoin is that once, you know, a central bank, you know, it could be a small country or like Venezuela, Iran, or, you know, starting, hoarding Bitcoin as a partial reserve asset.
Yeah, so I would just look at the numbers there, and I'll definitely track it. Like, we'll be able to tell if it's really cutting into the seniorage. Right now, it's a rounding error. So, and even the countries that it won't be a rounding error for, those countries themselves are a rounding error of the global monetary base. So that's an important thing. You know, like, not, I got 30. We'll have 40 probably by next year. But like, I got 30, the top floating. Need to look at floating, not fixed, but the top floating 30 fiat currencies in the world, 18 trillion. The US dollar, the euro, the yen, and the yuan, and then the Great British pound, formerly Great British pound, let's say, and the Indian rupee, they make up 90% of that pie. So top six make up 90% of the top 30. And that, like, Venezuela is a rounding error there. Like, there's no point of putting Venezuela into there because it's so, so small, especially when you look at it in dollar terms, regardless of how much inflation they do to, like, add that inflation rate to the blended rate that we report. But it's so, so small. And then, yeah, Bitcoin will be, like, there's no doubt that Bitcoin, it's already making an effect to the people there. It's great. It's absolutely great. Like, this is the beauty of the free market. It's being served by market money. All of those things, I completely agree with what everybody says about the beauty of Bitcoin there. But as a size of the seniorage that's able to be done today, it's just so small. You know, like I said, 17.5 trillion, 18 trillion is basically seniorage. That's money that's printed above central bank gold holding, official gold holding. It's massive. They're able to do it. They're able to, you know, enforce their will, pass their laws, strong arm whatever people need to do to believe in those currencies. And this is like not a new thing. You know, I mean, FDIC insurance started right after the Great Depression, while the Great Depression was on. You know, the ending of the main gold standard for the U.S. All of those things, that was, you know, 80 years ago. And this monetary experiment that we're on now with like pure fiat, like I said, pure fiat basic money backing other claims is only 50 years old. So there's nothing that tells me that it will be fast. And actually, I don't want to give financial advice or whatnot, but I do try to prepare myself generally for that. Like, I think it's great. Like, people should, if you're a main believer in Bitcoin, like, expose all you want. It's not financial advice, but there's nothing in my mind that shows that it will be fast. I hope that I'm wrong in a good way, because I'm not a fan of like doom and gloom, boom bust, like a massive cleanse of the system with good money to drive out bad. You know, you don't want people to be run out. That's how, like,
no, but realistic. I mean, you know, when you listen to these experts, such as Austrian economists like Thorsten Pollard, Markus Krall, I mean, these are like super, you know, knowledgeable people who are really even predicted the mass firings within the German, Deutsche Bank months before it happened. So they're saying it could happen. The recession could come even earlier than end of 2020. And it could start in Germany, you know, the like literally banks crashing. I think it's realistic. And with all the other compounding factors, with whatever negative interest rate policies and insolvency.
If you add up the negative columns, it certainly seems like there's a lot more things that could go wrong than go right. If you add up the negative columns compared to the positive columns of generally the economy, but particularly how the money system works. I agree. I mean, that's why we track this stuff. And I agree, like, since 2008, all of the sort of the general figures of what normally worked for central bank aren't working. Like, massive amounts of reserves, minimal amount of lending. Nobody's sure if the really price inflation will follow if lending does get done. Interest being paid on bank reserves. That's another huge thing. Like, you know, banks used to have to competitively lend out their reserves. That's how banking was, you know, was working. And you would see which banks needed more reserves than others. Maybe those banks should be lent at for a discount or a higher interest rate, so on and so forth. And now central banks in Europe, in the US and Japan, they're basically they're paying interest on the reserves to banks precisely because they're worried about banks lending too much of their created money out into the economy, but they want them to have that created money to cover these like sort of reserve ratios and these other things. So it's just all this weird, like paradoxical, strange things. And so, yeah, banks are now not buying like treasuries. They're not buying, you know, those shorter term maturities that I was talking about before. They're not matching liquidity at all. They're just looking at, oh, let's just park our money with the Federal Reserve, receive interest on our reserves. The Fed is now sort of just becoming this weird borrower. Another nice quote that George Selgin used to say, they used to be the lender of last resort. Now central banks are the borrower of first resort, meaning it's like the reserves now have become some weird loan that they're taking from banks. They're paying those reserves with interest. And so banks are like, well, we might as well just hold that. Let's not buy treasuries. And you saw that spike in there was a spike in the federal funds rate a month and a half ago, precisely because of this, because banks weren't buying other short-term treasuries, and so the Fed had to step in and buy. They had to sort of fill the gap, and that was where they're not calling it quantitative easing, but it basically is quantitative easing, where they're filling the gap of these government bonds that banks aren't purchasing themselves. So that's, again, that's the same story that's been happening for the last 10 years. It's a lot of intervention. It's a lot of distortion. I'm totally with all of the Austrian views there. Absolutely. I think that, like, we have the correct lens of the economy and everything else. But I do caution people when you're talking about anything, it's gold, silver, Bitcoin, you know, caveat emptor, you know, the market is relentless in how things go. And unfortunately, we just don't have a free market in money. You know, we have a massive, massive this X factor, which is the monopoly issuer of money that is the central bank in each country. And they can, you know, they will not let go of that power easily.
Yeah. But if the shit happens, I mean, if it really hits the fan and it goes by, you know, order of magnitude, you mentioned like the ultimate settlement, something in the beginning. You think Bitcoin could be like the ultimate settlement, like the super transition key to a new paradigm shift into, you know, new. So we don't have, you know, exactly all these scenarios, you know, chaos, panic, and pain, and suffering. I mean,
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. I hope that it will happen in a peaceful way if it does. But again, history has shown when monetary systems have broken down, you know, that's like the rise of wars, that's the rise of populism, dictators, people that think that they can give a glimmer of hope to people that have lost their savings, lost their jobs through, again, precisely the bad monetary policy that, you know, the state brought about. It's a bad track record from history. So I don't want to see it happen that way. I would love for Bitcoin to be a peaceful, and I'm not insinuating that you want that to happen, but
I'm saying, you know, that could be the transition, the only viable transition, maybe not smooth as imagined, but
yeah, it would be great. I mean, to have a peaceful, sound, you know, competitive monetary base type of money that starts to make its way into banks. It would be really interesting to see. I have to be honest there. Like that's just really, I think it's hard to predict. I think the state will stand ready to bail out, to back up, to backstop bad, further malinvestments of banks, all of those things. So I don't want to make any predictions there, but I will tell your listeners, like we're tracking a lot of that. We're going to try to expand that on our website to make it really easy to track a lot of these different money supplies. Because I think one thing I've learned doing this monetary base presentation is that a lot of these currencies like act a lot differently than the others. But it is true that, you know, the top six are 90% of the pie of the top 30. So we have to watch those probably the most. You know, I just tweeted a couple days ago, you know, how India cut their the old 500 and 1,000 rupee note. I think they added a new 1,000 rupee note since then. Some more secure note or whatever, probably RFID or something. But they cut that money stock like 25%, 26% exactly 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. Now it's 26% higher than it was just before the drop, like 70% higher than it was after the drop. And if you just look at it as a chart, it's almost like you have this one destabilizing thing from the Bank of India in the name of corruption or whatever, but really trying to test if they can get cash out of the economy. It was impossible. They put cash back into the economy. Now it looks just the same. So that tells me that this digitizing of cash is going to be very difficult. You just look around how hard it is for people to get into Bitcoin. I think it's going to be maybe slightly less hard to get into a central bank digital currency, but you know, it's very money is just a long-term generational thing, you know. Yeah. I think it's going to take some time, and I'm not optimistic that they're going to cut cash, because I see cash growing every year.
Really? Okay. Every
single bank. Yeah, even the cash component of the of those currencies generally grows. It doesn't grow as crazy as the reserve component, but it grows. And I just I don't see any like major mm-hmm. thing. But again, I hope I'm wrong for the good and the peaceful way, as you said, that Bitcoin can continue to eat into a lot of this this distortion, you know, that central banks cause. So
mm-hmm. The analysis you've been doing, is there like, or are you planning to do like an analysis? What's like the short-term, mid-term effect on the price of Bitcoin or the adoption rate or any kind of fluctuation, any kind of movement? Is it just esoteric what I'm saying?
No. As I like to just track more than I like to make predictive models. There's a lot of predictive models on price with Bitcoin, or you know, the stock to flow is one, but there's also like trying to gauge demand, trying to gauge trends in the power curve that Bitcoin makes, or the logarithmic curve, these log charts. There's all sorts of like predictive models that people are trying to do with price. I think that's a function of trading is interesting, might work for some people in the long term. It's just not as interesting to me to predict price, but I really like comparing price, you know, with other things, just like I like comparing, you know, demand deposits to the monetary base. It's actually just view what has factually happened, and then maybe if we can draw some conclusions there, you know, great. But so definitely we're gonna keep improving that. I think we have a good start here. But I do have a lot of you know, because Fernando and I as well, like we're kind of, I think like you, you know, we're into the Austrian economic side, but also maybe just the general econ side. Like there's so much amazing things going on in Bitcoin with Lightning Network and just more faster, better ways for noobs to get in. Mm-hmm. Like that's really growing a lot.
Yeah.
It's really great. Yeah. It's just not really necessarily what we're focused on. So mm-hmm. I think we're going to continue to just try to look at it as a proportion, as a scale compared to the rest of the economy, and then we'll see. And this is another thing too, like, you know, Nassim Taleb writes about this. Jim Rickards, who's not a fan of Bitcoin, writes about this. Like, definitely, I think if you look at monetary history, you'll see this, is that and general market history, is that markets tend to move in power curves. They don't move in linear curves. That's why all those predictive models about mortgage-backed securities in 2007, 2008 failed, because you're predicting, okay, standard inflation rate, rent levels increasing, expenses increasing a little bit more or less, very linear models going into the future. And then things, you know, will just be hunky-dory. In reality, you have these massive black swan events where it's sort of like a 100-year flood. You know, it just takes people by surprise, the shock, the economy has to adjust. You know, that's generally what tends to happen. So I wouldn't be surprised if something like that happened, but it would be very interesting to, obviously I think Bitcoin will succeed in the midterm, even if it doesn't, like, you know, gold fell a lot in 2009 during the crisis, just like everything else, but then gold rose. So like, I do think that there probably will be some surprises, but I do think if we look at the long-term sort of trends and the comparisons of how Bitcoin does compared to these other things, we might gain some insights. But, you know, right now, you know, to be honest, or to tell everybody, like, either that's an opportunity or, you know, it's just going to take a long time. Bitcoin really is a rounding error. Like the size of Bitcoin is a rounding error to the main monetary bases of the world, the main currencies, and the total monetary base of the world. So I think it could take a lot longer than people suspect.
This has been a fascinating, one of the most important, I think, educational pieces we've done, because it's all about education. So is there anything else, Matthew, that you think people should dive into? I'm going to, you know, put your Crypto Voices, your podcast, this excellent Twitter thread. So I really urge people, my listeners, to listen and to really read and understand, you know, the essence and the bigger picture of what is monetary base, what's the implications, Is there anything else you want to like add?
No, I think we covered it. Thanks a lot for your time, Kayvon. I just, yeah, we're at cryptovoices.com. The podcast is there and all the exhibits. We have some Bitcoin exhibits as well. Cryptovoices.com/basemoney is the monetary base exhibit, which probably Fernando and I have been more rigorous on, I guess I could say, than most in terms of just really trying to look at what it is versus the rest of things that act like money in society. So hopefully, you know, we can continue to work on that and it helps people, and you know, always happy to share the thoughts. So thanks a lot for your time.
Well, thank you, Matthew, and hope to see you soon, hopefully sometime soon in Vienna, because there's a satellite event coming on with organized by Daniel Wingen, you know, Value Bitcoin Conference.
Yeah,
so you know, so there's a little bit more hopefully activity in Austria, because it's a little bit passive, I think, compared to other countries. But that's my perception.
Well, so, lovely place.
Yeah. So really happy to, you know, have had this talk and learned a lot with my listeners. So yeah, talk to you soon.
Great. Bye. Thanks a lot. Thank you. Nice
talking with you. Bye, bye, Matthew. Ciao.
Welcome to the podcast show by Kayvon Devani, the Total Connector. Total Bitcoin, Austrian economics, the hardest and scarcest money ever created in human history, Bitcoin.